to you from the Forge of Freedom studio in the heart of America, a podcast dedicated to preserving freedom and inspiring personal success. Freedom is born and lives through you, the individual, and it dies in the shadows of tyranny. Motivating our listeners to become well-rounded, freedom-minded people with the body of an athlete, the mind of a stoic, and the spirit of a warrior. The Tree of Liberty lives on through you, the Forge of Freedom. And now here's your host, Alex Uli.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Forge of Freedom podcast. I'm your host, Alex Uli, and this is episode 64 of the Forge of Freedom. Today, I have a special guest with me on the show, Jeff Knox. Jeff is the director of the Firearms Coalition, an independent rights advocacy organization comprised of gun clubs, grassroots organizations, and individual activists. Founded in 1984 by gun rights legend Neil Knox, the coalition has been actively working to educate, inform, and influence the public and our servants for almost 40 years. So with that being said, today we're going to talk about the NRA and the struggles that it's been facing, and Jeff's efforts to reform and save the NRA, hopefully. So with that being said, Jeff, welcome to the show. Thanks for being on.
Thank you, Alex. It's nice to be here and happy to share what I know.
Yeah.
Or what I think I know.
Yeah. Well, thankfully for our listeners, I think you know a great deal more about the troubles facing the NRA than I do, the history of the NRA and some of the reform efforts that have been attempted and that are currently underway. So I think that our listeners will enjoy listening to your thoughts on this subject a great deal. I certainly look forward to our conversation. So thanks again for joining the show. If you don't mind just starting out, would you say a little bit about who you are and a little bit about the Firearms Coalition?
All right. Well, as you mentioned, the Firearms Coalition was founded back in 1984 by my father, Neil Knox. Dad had been a gun rights activist for his whole life. He really had his epiphany moment at National Guard camp in about 1957 when one of his fellow guardsmen, Belgian corporal by the name of Charles Denier, was telling him about his experience in World War II. Charles was just a teenager, a preteen, in World War II when the Germans came plowing into his little village and murdered his best friend and his entire family because his friend's father couldn't find a pistol that he had registered as having brought back from World War I. And as Charles told Dad this story, Dad was very moved, and when he got back home to the West Texas Sportsman's Club, he stood up at their next meeting and he said, "Hey, I want to know about your legislative policy committee and if I can participate in that." And the president of the club said, "Well, Neil, we don't have a legislative policy committee, so you're the new chairman." And it went on from there. Dad was a newspaper man. He was writing for gun magazines on a freelance basis. And in 1966, he got a job off of a blind posting in the back of Guns Magazine that was looking for an editor for a new firearms publication. That publication turned out to be Gun Week. And Dad became the editor of Gun Week and a major contributor to their pages, and got that off the ground, and then went on to be the editor and publisher of Rifle and Handloader magazines for Wolf Publishing. And throughout his writing career, he was always very involved in the political side. Dad was a national champion bench rest shooter. He was anything with a trigger, Dad could do well, and had numerous accolades in that regard. But he also was very keen on the gun rights issue and Second Amendment issues, and would frequently pen editorials encouraging people to be more involved and letting people know what was going on in Washington and so forth. So in 1975, when he learned that the NRA was planning to get out of the gun rights business completely, he and some others started looking closer, and in 1977, they staged a revolt at the NRA members' meeting in Cincinnati, and that was the turning point for the NRA. The NRA, from that point, moved to a much more firm footing in support of the Second Amendment, and it was just a year later that Harlan Carter convinced Dad to leave his home and his dream job in Prescott, Arizona, and go out to D.C. to do battle face-to-face with the Congress critters. And Dad took over NRA ILA and shifted that. The Washington Post referred to it as what once had been a paper tiger is now a sophisticated computerized lobbying juggernaut. And within 2 years of Dad taking over, he was listed as one of the most influential, one of the 100 most influential people in Washington, and really raised the bar for gun rights activism. The NRA at the time went from about 500,000 members to 2 million members, and shortly they had 3 million members. And that's when Dad was unceremoniously booted from the organization, or from his leadership role in the organization. And things took a not as good turn. And ever since then, since 1977, the Knox family has been actively trying to push the NRA in the right direction, a solid principled defense of the fundamental human right of firearms ownership and self-defense. And that became the Firearms Coalition in 1984. The NRA was negotiating behind the scenes with Mario Biaggi on the armor-piercing bullet ban, and they were reporting to their members that they were a hard no, and that they had laid down the law, and they weren't negotiating, and they weren't compromising, while at the same time they were very actively negotiating and compromising. And Dad created the Firearms Coalition to try and get the word out to people, to try and lobby the NRA to do what they should be doing. And we've continued doing that since 1984, so almost 40 years.
And that fight continues till today, and we'll certainly get into those issues with the NRA going on today, and the efforts of you and others to try to get the NRA to do what they need to be doing. But certainly your father, Neil Knox, was a legend in the gun rights movement. And you said the Knox family, you have, is it one sibling or multiple siblings?
I have a brother who's very involved, and two sisters who are tertiarily involved. And of course, my mother was Dad's strong right hand for many, many years. Sad to say that she's currently, dementia has pretty much taken her away from us.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear that. I know your father also, it's on your website, and I'll link to this so our listeners can have easy access to it. But he wrote a book, right? The Gun mm-hmm. Rights War. I can't see it here, but I think that, was it a foreword or an introduction that was written by Chris Knox? Is that your brother?
Chris annotated it. Chris put it together. It's actually a compilation of Dad's writings going all the way back to, I think, 1966. He wrote a major piece for Guns and Ammo about the Gun Control Act, the Dodd bill that was being pushed at the time. And really, in today's world, this, what people refer to as gun culture 2.0, it's really common for people to, gun owners, to dismiss FUDs and talk about the mistakes of the past. But I'll tell you what, if you own a gun today, thank a FUD, because those good old boys, the deer hunters and the target shooters, they might not have done everything perfect. And there are a lot of things that we wish that they would have done differently. But the mental, the position, the zeitgeist at the time was extremely different. And we, gun owners, were trying to be reasonable and trying to just get along. And we didn't know at that time. They didn't know. I was just a kid, but they didn't know just how vociferous and nonstop the hoplophobes really are. And the lessons that they learned, which you can easily see reading Dad's works back in the 60s and the 70s, you can see where we thought we needed to go and where we were making mistakes, and why we can't be reasonable now. We've learned that reasonable is not an option. Anything that we allow them to take or that we give them, they take and they run with it, and they push for more and more and more. The only reason that gun control doesn't work is because there's not enough of it. And that's their philosophy. And every time it fails, which they always do, their answer is more gun control. And there is no middle ground. And actually, you know, we sponsored a rally. We participated. I was very active in the creation of the rally in D.C. A couple of years ago, right at the beginning of the COOF. And one of our speakers at that was a fellow by the name of Dan Gross, who had been the president of the Brady campaign. And a lot of people got mad because we brought Gross into the conversation. But what he contributed to the conversation was the fact that he had left Brady because he realized it wasn't about saving lives, it was about getting rid of guns. And he disagreed with that. He still supports various forms of gun control and restrictions, but he tries to keep the focus on effective and saving lives. And we just haven't been able to prove to him that there's no such thing. You can't stop a murderer from doing what murderers do by restricting my gun rights. And I refuse to participate in anything like that. But it's good to have those conversations with people who are sincere in what their beliefs are. And I think that's important here in 2023 with cancel culture, what it is. I think we need to be careful not to be part of that cancel culture and to listen to other perspectives and educate them, let them know why they're wrong, because they're absolutely wrong.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to mention, most of my listeners are fairly informed in the gun community, but many of them aren't and come to this podcast for more broadly freedom-related perspectives. So I'd like to mention a few things. Number one, I think with the when you say he left Brady, that was the Brady campaign, right? Which is a gun control organization, or an organization that promotes gun control. And as you said, what's often referred to as reasonable gun control in their sense of what is reasonable. But like you pointed out, and I've heard Tom Gresham from Gun Talk make this point many times, what's reasonable is, let's talk about how many laws against or restricting the right to keep and bear arms we can repeal, because there are thousands of laws restricting the right to keep and bear arms, as you say, that most of which, probably all of which, don't work and are totally ineffective. So let's compromise on which ones we can repeal, not which ones we're going to add. That's the reasonable approach to take, not reasonable
and
in the sense that
all of the federal ones need to be repealed, because the federal government has no authority to be restricting firearms in any way whatsoever. And Of course, then we move on down to the states, and the state governments have very limited authority to do anything like that, if any at all. And of course, thanks to the Bruin decision, and again, all of you NRA bashers, the Bruin decision came straight out of NRA and the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association. And it was a much better decision than anybody ever anticipated. Justice Thomas just knocked it straight out of the park. And so I encourage everyone, please pray for Justice Thomas's health always. He is our rock in the Supreme Court, and God bless him.
Amen. So one thing I'd like to mention, and before we jump into the current state of affairs at the NRA, because like you say, there are lots of reasons to criticize the NRA, but there are lots of reasons we should be thankful for what the NRA has done. But when did you talked a little bit about the history of the Firearms Coalition. When did you get involved in earnest in the effort to sort of stem the tide of gun control?
Probably around age 14 was when I really started reading and started studying, and that of course grew over the years. Whenever I was close to Dad, I was actively involved with whatever he was doing, but the current iteration, and I remember someone asking me when I was in the Army what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I lamented that what I really wanted to do was what my dad does. Dad was at that time the executive director of NRA ILA, and I said, you know, that's what I would really love to do, but unfortunately, there's really only room for one Knox in that fight, and that was my thinking at the time. Dad was never big on nepotism, and so I didn't think that that was a possibility. In 2002, I was living in Washington State. I was running a radio station up there in Spokane, and I decided to put my money where my mouth was, and I made a run for the state legislature, for the state house, running in a solidly Democrat district as a Republican against a six-term incumbent who was fairly well-liked. And as a matter of fact, he was somewhat of a friend of mine, also a radio guy. And I would have him come in and sub on my radio station occasionally. But he had messed up, and I decided to challenge him. And I had to step down from my position with the radio station. And after I lost that race, not nearly by as much as people had anticipated, but I did lose the race. And I found myself out of a job and at loose ends. And Republicans don't take care of their young up-and-coming prospects as well as Democrats do. And I decided that I wanted to get involved in campaign strategy and campaign consulting. And I decided that to do that, I needed to go back to D.C. where everything was going on, take some classes. And Dad was also wanting to get a little bit of help so that he could write a couple of books that he had been talking about. So Janet and I moved back to D.C., and I started doing some ghostwriting for Dad and taking care of more of his daily work so that he could focus on some writing. And it turned out that God had different plans, because while I thought I was there to free up Dad to write, the reality was I was actually there to spend time with Dad and to free him up for chemotherapy, because he was very shortly after I got there diagnosed with severe colon cancer, and it took him in January of 2005. After Dad's death, there was a lot of hemming and hawing about what was going to happen with the Firearms Coalition. We, as a family, got together and discussed whether we wanted to try and keep it going. We talked with advisors like Bob Hodgdon of Hodgdon Powder was a dear friend. Ken Ayler is a dear friend of Ayler Chronographs. Bob Honeycutt, the editor of Shotgun News Magazine, where we had been publishing a weekly article for years. And all of them said, let's give it a shot. You guys should try it. Jeff is doing a lot of writing. The people like his writing. So Bob graciously allowed me to continue with the Knox Report Shotgun News, which is now Firearms News. And we sent out a newsletter, and Dad's supporters were overwhelmingly supportive of the idea of us continuing. And so from 2005 until 2011, I worked in Virginia, just outside D.C. I went up on the hill regularly and found out that that was a huge waste of time. It was much more effective to talk with legislative aides on the phone and through email than it was to go and try and get face-to-face time with Congress critters. And Janet and I were wanting to get back home to Arizona. And so the family decided, they agreed that we could purchase the business. And here I had been working for almost 10 years for free, basically. I was working another job full time, and never took more than about $1,000 a month from the Firearms Coalition. And so we bought it, and we moved to Arizona and kept it going. We didn't know at the time that Mom's dementia had kicked in. She was wanting out of the whole thing. Anyway, we moved to Arizona. I kept working at other jobs and keeping the Firearms Coalition alive until about 2013, when most of those other jobs went away, and we've continued since then. We made a move a couple of years ago down here to the Tombstone area, finally got our little house in the country, and we love it here. Had some family tragedies along the way, but so now here we are on our little piece of property out in the boondocks, and our 17-year-old grandson just turned 17. He's living with us and going to the local high school, and things are going well.
Wonderful. Well, I'm certainly glad that you continued the organization after the tragic loss of your father. I'm sure he would be glad to see that it's still going strong today. So that's a wonderful tribute to him and to the influence he had on you and your other family members. So,
well, and it's really uplifting when uplifting when I get notes from guys who have been with the coalition for 30 years or more, and they say your father would be proud, and that means a lot to me. It really does.
Yeah.
But at the same time. I always feel like that 4-year-old kid, you know, wearing his dad's cowboy boots that come all the way up above his thighs. I don't think that there's any way that I could ever fill Dad's shoes, but I've kept his boots moving in the right direction for the last 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I never knew your father, but I'm certain he would be proud. So thanks again for keeping it going and the wonderful work that you do. So one thing I'd like to mention, you mentioned Congress critters a few times. I like that phrase. I think so many people overestimate their ability to make change in Washington, D.C., in the swamp. And I think really the change is made out on the ground, in, you know, wearing the boots and fighting for change.
Right.
And that's kind of what you're up to today, right? Trying to reform the NRA. So I think with that in mind, would you mind to say a little bit about what's going on with the NRA, what's been revealed over the last few years in terms of its troubles some rather nefarious things that are going on within the organization, right, and what its hopes are for the future?
Well, let me start by saying that three other guys and myself have joined together as reform candidates, and we're circulating petitions to get our four names on the ballot for the NRA Board of Directors in the coming election. That's a tough row to hoe. We need to, each of us, collect 500 signatures from valid voting members of NRA. That's people who are life members or have been consistent annual members for at least 5 years. So we're trying to do that, and we'll talk more about that down the line. But the reason that we're trying to do that is that NRA is in a mess right now, and the board of directors is not doing what they need to do to clean up and correct the mess. Back in 2019, it really broke out into the public, though I had been writing articles of concern about what was going on inside NRA for several years. In 2019, an investigative reporter that had been hired by Mike Bloomberg, of course, Bloomberg is an anti-gun billionaire, and he has a propaganda mill called The Trace. And Bloomberg hired this guy, his name's Mike Spies, as an investigative reporter to dig up dirt on the NRA. And at the time, people were looking at some shady things that might have gone on with the way they were funding campaigns for Congress and Senate. There was also a scandal about their connection with a particularly attractive Russian spy. And then there was also a lot of concern about the salaries that were being paid at NRA and the funds that were going out to outside contractors in huge dollar amounts, and the lack of proper oversight of all of that. And it turned out, as Mike Spies started digging in, he found that the campaign finance issues were very difficult to prove, and there wasn't much interest in pursuing those. The Russian spy scandal was mostly just a tempest in a teapot. The NRA guys didn't do much wrong. There were things they could have done better in that situation, but it wasn't a huge scandal. But then he started finding whistleblowers that had recently been pushed out of NRA who had tried to raise the alarm about some of the problems within the organization. And those turned out to be huge, huge issues and major scandals. Personally, I think paying the CEO of NRA, Wayne LaPierre, over $1.5 million a year, I consider that just simply wrong. To send out letters to average Joe blue-collar gun owner begging for $20 donations and then putting those $20 donations by the thousands into the executive's pockets. That's not the way NRA is supposed to be. That's not the way any nonprofit organization should be. And we were busily doing that. Wayne has made as much as $3 million a year from NRA, and actually a little over five 1 year because of some retirement fund payout thing that I never have quite understood, but he got a $2 million, almost $3 million payout from the retirement fund that year. But it really comes down to, we were paying outside contractors tens of millions of dollars every year without proper oversight of those contracts, and many things that were required to be approved by the board of directors never were brought to the board of directors. Many things that required competitive bidding were never brought to competitive bidding. Many conflicts of interest that were uncovered that were supposed to be discussed with the audit committee were done so retroactively So, you know, Wayne did this and took this and accepted that, but failed to report it to the audit committee. But now he's reporting it to the audit committee. So they rubber stamp it and retroactively say it was okay. And then he continues. I don't think that the executive vice president of NRA should be flying on private jets and staying in presidential suite accommodations and having limo service. And I particularly don't think he should be doing that on my dime with his family going to the Bahamas, where he's spending time on a yacht that belongs to one of the contractors that he's giving sweetheart deals to. It's just, there's a lot of corruption out there. And what should have happened, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, a lot of it starts with Wayne and his mismanagement of the organization. But there's also another point here too, is that the board of directors hasn't been engaged like they need to be to prevent this sort of thing from happening. Can you say a little bit about that?
They haven't been providing the proper oversight. And it became really apparent after this story broke. The story was published in the New Yorker magazine just days before the NRA convention in Indianapolis in 2019. It turned out that then President Ollie North had been raising some of these issues and miraculously wasn't renominated for his second term as president. Traditionally, the president serves two terms and then steps down, and the first vice president is elected to be the president. But Ollie had served one term and was unceremoniously not renominated in 2019. And then Wayne actually accused him of trying to extort Wayne into resigning. Then we find out that Wayne had a contract that promised to continue paying him at full salary in perpetuity as a consultant. So not only were we paying him $1.7 million or more per year, but if he decided to walk away for any reason, he would continue to get paid that $1.7 million or more per year as a consultant, regardless of any contribution he might make. The treasurer that Wayne brought in at the time that he was elevated to the executive vice president position, a guy named Woody Phillips, had just retired and also taken a ridiculous golden parachute that kept paying him. When all of this broke, there was a lot of rumor that the Attorney General of New York, where NRA is chartered, we had advised them to move out of New York decades prior, but they were still chartered, are still chartered in New York, which gives the governor and the Attorney General oversight over the association. And there had been rumors that the Attorney General was going to bring a suit, starting an investigation. And NRA had instituted a cleanup program where they had gone back over contracts and brought things to the audit committee to get rubber stamped retroactively, and had instituted a few new policies and procedures, but there was no course correction regarding the people who had done the wrong in the first place. Specifically, Wayne LaPierre, the secretary John Fraser, the treasurer Woody Phillips, and Wayne's top assistant, a guy named Josh Powell. At the same time, they had just a couple of years before introduced NRA Carry Guard. They had revamped the whole education and training division, which had that in a shambles. Carry Guard was falling apart. It was being kicked out of numerous states for violating their insurance rules and regulations. NRA had filed suit against the governor of New York because they had advised banks and insurance companies to stop doing business with them. It was just a mess. And at that point, the proper thing for the NRA board of directors to have done would have been at a minimum to suspend Wayne LaPierre, to move him and the other three named defendants that eventually were named in the New York lawsuit, but suspend the top executives, do a very thorough audit and reorganization, reevaluation of all of the policies and procedures, make as much course correction as they could, and replace anybody who had fallen short of their fiduciary responsibilities. Instead, and I wrote an article at that time saying that they had two choices. They can either do this and then stand naked before the court and say, here we are, we've fixed all of these problems, we've gotten rid of the people who caused these problems, and we've established this for going forward. Court, what do you say? Let's fix this. And at that point, I think that everything would have been fine. We would have taken a hit for the problems, and we would have had to prove to the membership that we now had things back on track, and we were dotting every I and crossing every T. But as I said in that article, their other option would be to circle around Wayne LaPierre, circle the wagons around Wayne, and continue circling straight down the drain. And that's the option that they chose. And we have seen it ever since. Our revenue, our annual revenue in 2017, 2018, annual revenue was almost $400 million. That's just staggering. $400 million coming into NRA every year. And by 2022, that was down to about $194 million a year.
Wow.
Just staggering. Membership. Almost half of our members are life members, and the other half are annual members. The life members, they've already paid their dues. All of that money has been spent. The annual members are the guys who keep the organization alive. We've lost at least 25% of our annual members since 2016, 2018. It could be as much as 30 to 40%. Our revenue from dues has gone down by almost 40%. In any right-thinking organization, the CEO would be fired. But they keep holding on to Wayne. I can't begin to understand why. They have reelected him as executive vice president, CEO, five times since this story broke. They reelect him year by year, and they've reelected him five times since this scandal broke, and that's just shameless.
And as you say, I was at the NRA, the 2019 NRA annual meeting, and that second option, that sort of circling of the wagons around Wayne LaPierre, happened pretty quickly. There was a lot of movement, a lot of shuffling, but eventually the wagons, as you say, did circle around him. And I think part of that, we talked about this a little bit in previous conversation, I think is partly due to the structure of the NRA and the way mm-hmm. that the board is organized and composed.
Right.
Would you say a little bit about that? Because, I mean, there are just so many members of the board, and it just seems like so many of them are in there in support of Wayne, and that's their sole purpose.
Right. The NRA Board of Directors is 76 members. It was 75 for many, many years, and then some lawyer found a clause that he thought that we had to elect one in the open membership, and so we started electing one director during the annual meeting of members, 20 years ago. But thinking back, the NRA Board of Directors was once upon a time like the board of directors of your state association. It was a shooting club, and moving on to the board of directors was kind of a badge of honor. And so they kept expanding the size of the board. And it's always only a handful of people who are actually doing the work of the board of directors. Most of the members of the board serve on a variety of committees, and they do work, but it's not the work of managing the NRA. And with 76 members, it can't be the work of managing the NRA because it's just too big. You can't get consensus. You can't manage a board that large. The NRA board of directors now, you know, that we're a $200 to $400 million a year. And I think it's really important to note that all of the other national gun rights organizations together don't comprise 10% of what the NRA draws in every year, or was drawing in every year. They barely reach 10% of what the NRA is currently bringing in. And so people who say, you know, let it go, we don't need it, there's better organizations. Well, those better organizations don't do everything that the NRA does and can't seem to garner the membership and the contributions that the NRA has. So I think that's really important to note. And one of the reasons that I'm so dedicated to try and reform NRA rather than simply watching it die. So my idea on the board of directors is that it needs to be cut down to somewhere like 9 to 13 members, that the current board, the 76 that we have, needs to be scooted over into something that we call an advisory committee. It needs to be trimmed down to about 50 members, so you have one elected in each state from the residents, NRA member residents of that state. And that advisory committee does all of the committee work that the NRA board currently does, and they appoint the professional board of directors that actually runs the association. I think that would be much more logical, it would be much more responsive, it would be much more accountable. And if I get the opportunity, I will push a restructuring to that direction. But as it is, we have a handful of members of the board of directors who are old and established and are deeply committed to Wayne. And frankly, Alex, it's really hard, and I understand this, to have someone that you consider a dear friend, someone who you're very close to and that you respect tremendously, to look you in the eye and say, trust me, I didn't do this. We did everything by the book. This is just a witch hunt. It's just an anti-gun propaganda scheme. And if you'll stick by me, we'll get through this. It's hard to walk away from that. It's hard to, yeah. It's hard to say, wait a minute, I think you're lying to me. But ever since that 2019 meeting, when Wayne, in essence, did that, he looked each board member in the eye and said that. And then the prominent board members, the Marion Hammers and so forth, they individually went to people and said, you've got to support Wayne. He's our only hope. This is just a witch hunt. You've got to trust me. We know something you don't know, and we can't tell you, but trust us, we're going to win this thing any day now. And that any day now has stretched out to over 4 years and has cost us at least $200 million in attorney's fees alone. $200 million. Yep. We have one law firm that was paid over $60 million last year. And we expect that we're going to pay them well over $60 million this year. And that's not Second Amendment advocacy. That's not litigation to support Bruin. That's strictly the legal costs of defending Wayne and company. And that's a huge problem.
Yeah, huge problem. And simultaneously, like you said, with the downward trend in revenue from 400,000 mm-hmm. 400 million to less than 200 million just since 2018, I think you said.
Yeah.
So this huge increase in legal bills defending Wayne and the NRA, and huge decrease in revenues. And it's all on the backs of the donations, the small donations from members nationwide. Well, you alluded to this earlier that when you were talking about the pay of the executives of the NRA and Wayne LaPierre in particular, that payment is being made with these donations from the millions of members nationwide, the blue collar members, the hardworking members, the people who care about the right to keep and bear arms. And those dollars are being spent to defend these actions of Wayne. So that's incredibly sad, because one of the things that's always been so wonderful about the NRA is that it's had influence because of its members. And, unlike the Bloomberg organizations that are funded by Bloomberg, the billionaire, and have very little institutional energy other than what can be bought. The NRA is powerful because they have so many members, so many motivated members who want to protect the right to keep and bear arms, and
right.
They're
true
unfortunately
grassroots.
Yep, exactly. One thing you mentioned too is that I think is important to point out again that these other organizations like the Second Amendment Foundation, the Firearms Policy Coalition, Gun Owners of America,
all good organizations.
They don't, great organizations, and they're doing wonderful work.
Absolutely.
But as you said, they don't account for even 10% of what the NRA was able to account for at least a few years ago.
Right. And while NRA has been falling, these groups have been growing, but they haven't grown nearly as much as NRA has depleted. So we have literally over a million guys who have walked away from the gunfight because they walked away from NRA. They walked away from NRA and they have not shifted allegiance to any other organization. They haven't moved their donations to other organizations. You look at it in YouTube videos and comments on articles, and you would think that everybody has shifted over to some other organization and making their contributions. And a personal frustration for me is we've been running the Firearms Coalition for almost 40 years, and I write these articles pointing out what's going on with NRA, and invariably I get multiple comments down underneath from guys saying, well, I'm sending all of my money to SAF or GOA or NAGGR or Firearms Policy Coalition. And they're going, guys, just a couple of bucks my way would really help to keep me reporting this and keep you informed, you know. But yeah, it's we've lost over a million members, and they haven't gone somewhere else. They've just gone. And Wayne LaPierre, initially they were saying, well, Wayne can go out and go to these functions and he can raise $1 million in a day. Yes, he could, back when he was trusted. He can't anymore. He doesn't get phone calls from presidents anymore. He doesn't have the political sway anymore. He doesn't have the fundraising sway anymore. So the only reason that they're holding on to him is through loyalty to him personally. And while that's somewhat admirable, at the same time, it's not the way to run a business. And it's incredibly frustrating to me. But, when we have an NRA convention and 80,000 people show up to look at all the guns and gear down on the floor and to go to hear the politicians speak, and maybe 500 to 1,000 actually go to the members meeting and hear the business of NRA. But when you've got 80,000 NRA members in that room, and half of them are life members, possibly more than half are life members, that's 40,000 NRA donations, NRA memberships that are going straight into Wayne's pocket, because that's how many people it takes to pay his salary at $35 a pop. And that's, I'm sorry, that's, it's sinful is what it is. It's immoral, and it shouldn't be, and it shouldn't have been leading up to this. And these guys who don't understand that, I have trouble understanding where their heads are. Back in 1982, NRA had grown to almost 3 million members from half a million members. My dad, as executive director of NRA ILA, was being paid about $60,000 a year and got a company car and a very small expense account. Harlan Carter was being paid about $85,000 a year. When you convert that into current money, that comes out to $250,000, $350,000 a year. Wayne was being paid in 1997. He was being paid about $250,000 a year. Dad was the first vice president. He was in line to be the president the following year. Marion Hammer was the president. And Dad, being one of the officers, the three officers, the president, the first vice president, and the second vice president, are also the executive compensation committee. They're the ones who decide how much the executives get paid. Dad was holding the line. He was also holding the line on how much we were paying contractors for fundraising letters and things like that. And they got rid of him. They brought in Charlton Heston specifically to bump Dad out of the chairs. And a year later, Wayne was being paid $400,000 a year. And 2 years after that, he was being paid $600,000 a year. And about 2 years after that, he was being paid $800,000 a year. That's wrong. It shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have been allowed. And frankly, the audit committee that we have now, the chair and vice chair of the audit committee are Charles Cotton and David Coy. David Coy, by the way, is up for re-election in this next election. Please don't vote for him. But David Coy was the chairman of the audit committee for many years, and then he became vice chair when Cotton moved up to be the chairman. But they are still the chair and vice chair of the audit committee. That's the committee that's supposed to be looking with a fine-tooth comb at all of the transactions within NRA and making sure that they're kosher. And these two specifically have failed hugely in their fiduciary duties, but they are currently not only the chair and vice chair of the audit committee, but they are the president and the second vice president of the association. I have a big problem with that too.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned earlier is that since 2019, when this news about sort of corruption within the NRA became more public, you'd been reporting on it for some time, about some concerns within the NRA. But the message from the NRA since 2019 has been, like you said, trust us. We know what we're doing. We're fighting for you. We're doing the right thing. This is just a witch hunt, all these things. Well, through lots of litigation, which, as you said, has cost the NRA millions and millions of dollars, we've learned that a lot of these allegations were, in fact, true.
Yes.
And that there has been this massive mismanagement and sort of dereliction of duty to the members. And
much of that was admitted along the way, that the first story would be, no, we didn't do that. And then the second story would be, well, there was a reason that we did that. And then the third story would be, well, we didn't know that that was happening. You know, it was story after story where they admitted that they had lied previously. And now they have a news story. And for some reason, the members of the board of directors keep believing the news story. And I can't fathom that.
Yeah. And the NRA continues to fall off a cliff financially. Right. Their expenses are rising. Their revenues are falling. Maybe facing bankruptcy in the near future.
And their influence facing. And their trust has fallen. And that's
indeed.
That's significant.
Yeah, huge.
And I want to add, before we get too much farther, I want to add that it's not only the money. The money is a big deal. There's no question mm-hmm. about it. But through the years, Wayne came up as a political activist. He was a legislative aide to a Democratic state legislator in Virginia, and I believe he became an LA for a congressman. There were rumors that he was up for the job of Tip O'Neill's chief of staff when he took the job at NRA in 1978. But he was not a gun guy, and he was not a gun activist. He was a political activist. He was a political player. And like so many politicians, it seems that his approach to the Second Amendment is one from a political standpoint, that it's a chip on the table. And over the years, when NRA has been pressed, Wayne has repeatedly violated the core principles of our fight. After Columbine,
the Bones Talk ban. Right.
Right. That's the most recent that Wayne
right.
came out with a joint statement with him and Chris Cox. And I wrote several articles condemning this and calling on the board to repudiate it. But he said, the NRA believes that these devices should be more tightly regulated. And he had Donald Trump's ear at that time. Prior to that, he had stated that the NRA believes in zero tolerance, no guns in schools, period. He had stated that the NRA believes in background checks at all gun shows. He had stated that the NRA believes that red flag laws with due process should be passed in every state. These are not my principles or my goals, and should not, are not the goals of or the principles of the National Rifle Association of America, yet we allowed our chief executive officer to claim that they were. And mm-hmm. that's, again, inexcusable.
So the NRA is facing not only deep financial trouble, a deep problem with trust. They've had a history in recent years of engaging in using our core fundamental right to keep and bear arms as a bargaining chip for political purposes. Mm-hmm. How do you change that? And how do you respond? You've talked a little bit about changing the composition of the board. How do you change that? How do you change the direction of the NRA? And what do you say to people that say, it's a lost cause? Let's just let it collapse. Let's let it fail.
Well, I honestly believe that the major reforms are going to come from the courts. At this point, the lawsuit from the New York Attorney General is scheduled to go to trial in early 2024, January or February of 2024. I think there's a good chance that the NRA will again declare bankruptcy, this time with very solid grounds for doing so, because they are in way over their heads at this point. They've got the headquarters building in Northern Virginia up for sale. They're talking about trying to move to Texas in this economy. I don't understand that. But the whether it's through the bankruptcy or a new bankruptcy or some other an attempted settlement or actually going to trial in the New York suit, which right now the NRA is demanding a jury trial in Manhattan. I'm not sure where they think they would find a jury that would give them a fair shake in Manhattan, but that's what they're demanding. I actually think that that's probably mostly a ruse on the part of their attorney, Bill Brewer, to delay the court case by demanding the jury trial. It would be very complicated to do this as a jury trial, and the judge doesn't want to do a full jury trial, and that's what they're demanding. So one way or another, I think that the courts are who's going to eventually decide this. I am pretty sure that the NRA as we know it is not going to exist by the time that I could be elected to the board of directors. The fact that I'm running, that Phil and Rocky and Dennis and I are running, it could give us some sort of legal standing to at least answer questions that the judge might have about NRA's goals and objectives and what we want and what the members need for the NRA to be. We're not sure. But if I just sat it out and watched to see what happens, I wouldn't be part of the solution. By running, it gives me the opportunity to maybe be part of the solution when the solution comes. But I think that definitely a court is going to be the impetus for reform within the NRA. I don't think it's going to come from the board of directors ever. I think that I think it's very likely that the court will fire all of the executives, put a controller in charge, dismiss the entire board of directors and hold a special election for new directors, and restructure the entire thing from the top down. I've written out in previous articles my detailed ideas about what we could do and how we might like to see it reformed. I don't see it happening from the inside. If I get inside, if there still is an NRA that I can be a part of the board of directors, that's what I'll advocate. Fire me. Hire some professionals to be the board of directors, guys who have solid Second Amendment bona fides and solid business knowledge and acumen. Wayne has neither of those, and he's been running the association for the last 20 plus years. So that's where I see it, and that's why I continue to fight and continue to bang my head into a brick wall and tilt at windmills.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, but sort of the way I see it, at least figuratively, is that there need to be the right sorts of people in place to pick up the pieces when there are pieces to pick up. And right. There are lots of bad pieces to pick up, and we want somebody in place that knows the organization, that knows the gun rights community, that knows what the core fundamental right of, to keep and bear arms means, so that there are lots of great parts of the NRA that still exist, including its members, and we want the right sorts of folks Absolutely. To lead it to pick up the pieces, whether that's Absolutely. Through bankruptcy or through some other mechanism.
Right, and one of the big concerns is, again, back to trust. If the judge appoints an overseer, whatever you want to call him, a trustee, to oversee the operations of the NRA and the reformation of the NRA, how much will the members trust that person? It's going to be difficult to find someone who has both the business acumen and the credibility within the community to do that. I think that, you know, we have to, and I've said this for many years, excuse me. Anyway, I've said this for many years that I think that the executive vice president should either be a CEO or should be our chief spokesperson. I think trying to make him both is a mistake. There are very few people who have the chops to be able to actually do that and do a good job at both jobs. Ideally, I think probably the executive vice president should be a Second Amendment purist who knows how to hire somebody who knows how to run a business, a big Yeah. business, because NRA is big business. But with all of our liabilities that's producing the magazines, running our physical infrastructure, supporting our education and training, supporting our competitions, supporting our gun collectors and our museum, our fantastic museums. With all of those liabilities and with the life members no longer contributing, they don't pay dues. If we don't have a good, strong, growing annual membership, we can't survive. One of the good things, one of the high notes out there, is that we have the NRA Foundation. The NRA Foundation is flush with money. They have set up a number of endowments that are multi-million dollar endowments. That's money that can't be directly touched for things, although they've loaned a lot of money to the NRA in recent years. And the NRA Foundation is currently under suit by the Attorney General of Washington, D.C., and we don't know where that suit's going to go. I think that there's a very, just based on the wording of the complaint, I think there's a very good chance that the foundation will be forced to sue the NRA to try and recoup some of the money that has flowed across into those coffers. But even if the NRA completely collapsed, I think that there's a possibility that the foundation could reconstruct it, but it would never be what it has had the potential to be. And I think the NRA was only what we wanted it to be. And I'm a little biased on this point, but I think it's only been what we really wanted it to be for about 4 years. Between 1979 and 1982, when Harlan Carter was the executive vice president and Neil Knox was the executive director of NRA ILA. That's when we were growing and marching and building, and NRA members were proud to be NRA members. Charlton Heston, while he was the president of the association, was a big boon. He was helpful once he got on the right script. He was able to open doors and bring up our prestige. My mother had advised that we hire him as our official spokesperson years before he became a member of the board of directors. But, you know, we can look back, and frankly, there are very few people who have a knowledge of NRA history that's as deep as mine, because I've been paying attention to it since I was about 15 years old. You know, it's a difficult situation, and I have no idea where it's going to go, how it's going to end up. So much depends on what the judges involved determine and who they put in what position and how it goes from there, and whether the members will trust those people, and whether we can get back on track. It's a horrible thought to me to think of the NRA completely melting down and becoming a non-entity in the future. And so I keep pushing.
One thing I'd like you to talk about a little bit is, you have these petitions on your website, firearmscoalition.org, and I'll link to that in the show notes, but you've got the petition for you, and then you have three others here for Phil Journey, Rocky Marshall, and Dennis Fusaro. Would you mind to say a little bit about each of those folks and why you support their campaign or their mission to become members of the NRA Board of Directors?
Okay. Yeah. Of the four of us, I've talked about myself, so let me talk about the others. I've known all of them for years. Actually, Dennis, I've probably known Dennis for almost 40 years. He walked into our offices back in, somewhere around 1984, and was looking for a job as a Second Amendment activist. He eventually went to work for Gun Owners of America. He did some work for Right to Work. He's done a lot of political consulting, and he's a bit of a troublemaker, is Dennis, and I like that about him. Some people don't, but Dennis knows how the political game is played, and he's good at it. Rocky Marshall
it's good to have somebody by your side who can sort of get in the mud,
absolutely,
get in the slop, and make some trouble. Yeah,
that's right. And Dennis is very good at that. but he's also a very sharp guy and a very hard worker, and he understands what's going on, and I depend on him for good advice. I was surprised when he actually told me that he was going to run. I had him on my list of people to encourage to run, and he called me and told me that he was going to, and so I was pleased with that. Rocky Marshall is a businessman out of Boerne, Texas. Rocky is the guy I know the least. I've only met him a couple of times, but he's served on the board. He's gotten himself elected at least once, maybe twice, but always short fill-in terms. And he's tried to do the right thing when he was on the board. And I salute that, and I applaud that. And I hope that we can get him on the board again. He understands business. He understands finances. And he knows how to read a spreadsheet. And that's a worthwhile understanding to have on your side. And then the other candidate is Judge Phil Journey. And I've known Phil at least 20 years, if not longer. Phil served on the board back in the 90s with Dad. He's been a regular presenter at the Gun Rights Policy Conference for many years. And Phil is a judge out of Kansas. He's also served in the state Senate in Kansas. He's also an avid shooter and gun collector, and an all-around great guy. And Phil was on the board until this last election, and they didn't renominate him, and we didn't have the time to put together a campaign for him that really worked. And really, they changed the rules on how many signatures you need to get on the ballot. They upped that significantly. Once you get on the ballot, it's still very, very difficult to get elected, because most NRA members get all of their information about NRA from NRA publications. And NRA publications are controlled by Wayne LaPierre and those who are loyal to him. And so it's challenging. It's really challenging to get anyone elected by petition, and we're going to try.
Yeah, and these petitions, once again, they're available on your website, firearmscoalition.org, and I'll certainly
right.
share and those. I'd encourage people to download yeah. them, to print them, and to mail them in. That's the best way to do it, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And you don't even need to download them. You can print them directly from my website. The petitions, let's see if I've got one right here. Here's what the petitions look like. And if you can see, it's landscape format, that this is the 11-inch and this is the 8.5 going up and down. They're posted on my website this way. So you print them in portrait rather than landscape, because if you try and print them in landscape, all of this is going to turn this way and be crunched up with white space top and bottom. And the NRA cares about that. If it's not printed correctly, they will disavow the entire petition and won't allow it. So what we ask, we're running low on time, and so what we ask is print out a petition and sign it if you're an NRA voting member. If you get a ballot in your magazine, your NRA number is on the label of your magazine, as is the proper address and how they have your name. And that's important too, is they have to be able to look at it and say, yes, this is this guy, and yes, this is his number, and yes, that looks like his signature. With the time being what it is, I ask people to print one copy, sign it, put in the information, and mail it back to me, and I'll distribute them to the other guys, and then print out another copy and go seeking other people to sign it. But what often happens is guys will say, well, I can get so-and-so and so-and-so, and I can go down to the gun club and I can collect some signatures, and they run out of time. And so it doesn't get to us in time to be of any use. So get the signatures that you can right away and send it in, and then see if you can get some additional signatures. That's how I would ask you to do it.
And when do you need the signatures, Jeff?
It's our deadline is we have to turn them in during the first week of November. And so we need to get them by the third week of October. So we've got 3 weeks, right. and there's mail time in the midst of that. So please go ahead and get it signed and mail it back to me. If you can't find an NRA member number, go ahead and leave that blank. We can call NRA and ask them to look it up for us. But again, that's just adding more work and more time to what we're doing. It's on your NRA magazine label if you get one. It's up in the top right corner of the label, and it's a long bunch of digits that start with a bunch of zeros. The zeros are just placeholders. They don't count. You don't have to include them. Just start with the first real digit that's there after all of those zeros.
One thing I'd like to mention too, I know you mentioned the Firearms Coalition, but you also write, and your work is picked up on other websites as well. You mentioned Firearms News. I think your work is also picked up by AmmoLand. Where else can people find your work?
Those are my primary. Most of what I write is republished on my website, and you can go back for decades looking at weekly columns, and you can really kind of get a taste of the news of the day at the time from that. But AmmoLand, I try to be in there every week. Firearms News, I try to be in there every issue, but I get overloaded and don't get all the way. And I also produce a newsletter. It's kind of irregular. I try and do quarterly, sometimes a little more than quarterly, but it's been a bit of a rough couple of years for us, and I've not been as good at getting those newsletters out as I would like to be. Anybody who's interested on the website, if you give me your name and address, I'll be happy to mail you a newsletter. If you make any kind of contribution, we'll add you to the list and we'll mail you the newsletter. We're working with a web designer to try and get that out by email and other means. But those are the main ways. I occasionally write freelance for some of the gun magazines because I do a little bit of just regular gun writing. And I try and do that, but the main are Firearms News and AmmoLand and my website and my newsletter.
Well, I certainly appreciate your work. I've been reading your work really since 2014, and I think your contributions to the community, to the right to keep and bear arms, and to the fight to preserve it are invaluable. So I thank you for the work that you put in, and I hope that our listeners will certainly get on your website and sign a petition and send it in, because we want these folks, you and these other folks, Phil Journey and the others that you've mentioned here, to get in a position where the NRA can be reformed when there are pieces to pick up. And that will happen, I think, sooner rather than later. We don't know, of course, like you said, but we want the right folks in place, because I think that the right to keep and bear arms needs a strong NRA. And of course, these other organizations are doing great work, but the NRA is hard to replace, and it's not getting replaced completely despite the excellent efforts of these other organizations. So thank you so much for the work that you do.
Well, thanks for having me, Alex. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I, as a matter of fact, I should say you and I've been reading your work for quite some time, but you and I just recently met at Gun Rights Policy Conference. It was my first time attending, and for those who don't know, the Gun Rights Policy Conference is an event put on by the Second Amendment Foundation, and it was a great event for me to meet lots of wonderful folks in the community, the gun rights community. So it was great to meet you, of course. And when I realized that we were under a bit of a time crunch to get these petitions signed, you and I exchanged some emails and decided to go ahead and get this podcast recorded so that we could get it out to folks. So thanks for joining the show under such short time constraints.
Well, thanks for giving me the time. I appreciate it. And I encourage folks, like you say, it'll be in the show notes, but firearmscoalition.org is the website. There's lots of information there. And I hope folks will visit and maybe sign a few petitions for us.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much again for joining the show. I think certainly this mission runs in your blood. I think that's easy to say. I think you're doing a wonderful job carrying on the mission that your father embarked on. And hopefully that we can continue this fight together for quite some time. And hopefully with a functional and resilient NRA going forward in the not too distant future.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Well, thanks again, Jeff. And I hope everybody enjoyed the show. If you did, don't forget to like and subscribe. Please share it to help get out the word to sign these petitions to help reform the NRA, because we need a healthy and resilient and vibrant NRA. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And until next time, remember, you are the Forge of Freedom.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Forge of Freedom. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss a future episode. For more information or to connect with Alex, you can go to forgeoffreedom.com or follow him on Twitter @ForgeOfFreedom. Until next time, remember, you are the Forge of Freedom.